You're on the Last Post radio show with Greg T. Ross, and it's my great pleasure to introduce longtime Last Post supporter, Peter Gerz. Peter can tell us what he does. He does so many things, but he's an art aficionado. He's a former ABC radio announcer and so many other wonderful things. How are you, Peter?
Thank you, and I love your magazine. I love The Last Post. You've done a magnificent job with it. And if ever I need a B-Day, a portable B-Day, I know where to go, because you always have that wonderful portable B-Day ad in the back of your excellent magazine.
They've been a great support over the years.
It's raised the profile of the veteran, and it's just always a good read. You find marvelous people. I've got you remember that issue you did with the wonderful Nolene Brown on the cover?
I remember it well. It was November 2017.
I got her to sign that cover, and I treasure that. There's a good stick, Nolene Brown. She's hilarious. I think she was described as the woman with Sydney in her voice.
she's so funny, Peter. Detailing her life, her first job was in a library or something.
She's been on my mind because the last two plays I've directed, Patrick White's A Cheery Soul, which is set in a fictional suburb of Sarsaparilla, it was really Castle Hill, which was a sort of almost a country town out of Parramatta, but now, of course, a suburb. Right. He called it Sarsaparilla, but we needed Sydney accents for that. And now I'm doing this play by Ron Blair, which is 50 years old, The Christian Brothers. And that's about a teaching Christian brother. Did you go to a Catholic school, Greg T. Ross?
No, look, I didn't, Peter. But I tell you what, I saw the promo for your Christian Brothers play. Tell us all about it.
Well, it's a beautiful play. I've done it twice before over the years. 50 Years Old by Ron Blair, and it's a life in the day of a Christian brother, a teaching brother, set in 1956 in a, well, we presume Sydney, and he's a good man, but flawed, like all of us, and he's struggling with teaching, he's struggling with his faith, and he's whilst also trying to inculcate education and faith in his charges, and it's a funny, beautiful, loving piece. He doesn't, when I say loving, he beats the bejesus out of one particular kid. There's a chair on stage which stands for the naughty boy. And this horrifies people now. But, of course, corporal punishment was endemic in schools, not just, of course, Catholic schools, but all schools.
That's right.
Government schools as well. Were you ever beaten at school?
Yeah, actually, I was going to relate a story. Yes, I was, and I swear it wasn't my fault. But I remember waiting outside the principal's office.
Everyone says that. I was a bit of a goody two-shoes. I wasn't beaten, but, I mean, I knew kids who were. But it's horrifying to look at that now. But, you know, it was that era of, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child. It was certainly part of education up until, see, corporal punishment in schools. Well, I can only speak, I think, for, well, you know, Australian schools. We had corporal punishment until 2000, and in non-government schools, 2015. So it's only relatively recent. I think in government schools, even in the 70s, only the principal or the deputy principal could enact corporal punishment. But
actually, that's right, Peter. That's right. But I do remember. I do remember we went to a high school in Adelaide, and they were short of teachers, so they drafted this guy from Flinders University. He was a maths teacher, and if you looked at him, you'd think he was the most peaceful, loving, vegetable eating character you'd ever. He should be at Woodstock. But by Jesus, Peter, he'd take you out in the hallway and he'd put his fist on your back with some force, and quite dangerous, really.
Well, it's all of that, but he's also a loving man, and someone who I think we learn to like and to understand. And it's a beautiful piece. It just hums this paean to this Christian brother in the play called Christian Brothers. Mm. Then for the Fringe, and I've been involved in the Fringe incredibly, Greg T. Ross, since I think 1976 in Adelaide. And this will be the 10th year of my own Fringe show. I do these sort of one-man pieces, although I do have special guests. But I don't quite know what they are. I call them sort of platform pieces.
Yeah.
They've had titles over the years like, you know, Smoked Ham, Hard Rubbish, That's Best right. We Forget. And and this year it's called If Affected, Do Not Drive or Operate Heavy Machinery, which is the warning on a lot of medicinal drafts.
They used to put that on Nodos.
Yes. No, I had Nodos once at Flinders, and I was, you know, I was sort of using it to stay up all night to write essays, which of course were late, and I'd taken too many Nodos, and I sort of tripped out at the Marion Shopping Centre, as I recall, when the Marion Shopping Centre was there was Compass Court, John Martin's, and four shops. That was the Marion Shopping Centre. Now it can be seen from space. It's so big.
It's got its own postcode, Peter.
Exactly. And in this show, I've written a little play called Now Is the Winter of Our Discount Tents, which is a sort of conversational piece. Ever since COVID, two mates have been coming here on a Sunday afternoon. You're welcome too, Greg T. Ross, if you're ever in town.
Yep.
But mainly it's two mates. And they sit around and drinking my booze, and we talk crap, you know, as only mates can, you know, absolute crap.
Yes.
And one day I thought, gee, this would make a play. And it's a sort of a conversation piece that's in the middle of my Fringe show. And finally, in the Fringe, we have, last year we did Hamlet in 15 minutes in a garden at Holden Street Theatres, in a sunken garden. And this year we're doing Romeo and Juliet in 15 minutes. So the entirety of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet in 15 minutes. We do it all in 15 minutes, and then we do...
I'd love to be over for that. I'd be loved to be over for that. That sounds absolutely amazing.
And then having done it in 15 minutes, we do an encore, and we do the whole play in a minute, and then we do the whole play in 10 seconds. So it's a bit of fun, and some good performers in that, and it's something I really enjoy.
How revolutionary, Peter. How revolutionary, the 15-minute, the minute, and the 10 seconds. That's incredible. I'd love to see it. So the Fringe, you've been involved in since 1976. How's it faring these days, Peter Gers?
Well, it's huge. It's huge. I think there are 1,800 different shows this year.
Jeez.
And they have various hubs. I like Holden Street Theatre is where I work because it's more for theatre. But they have, you know, as you know, the beautiful Gluttony, which is a South Australian hub, and across the road from the Garden of Unearthly Delights, which I've always called the Garden of Melbourne Entrepreneurs. there's things happening everywhere. It's the second largest arts festival in the world, other than Edinburgh, of course, on which it's based.
That's right. And what date does it start, Peter, the Fringe?
The 21st of February to the 23rd of March. And there is, incredibly, something for everyone. I mean, yes, it's marvellous. It's a good time to be in Adelaide. And of course, we have the festival, our Adelaide Festival, which we've had since 1960. Mm-hmm. And it's now, has for the last sort of 10 years, been yearly rather than biennial, which I think it's a bit of a shame. I wasn't crazy about that idea. I think it was better, actually, when it was every second year. I think it was bigger. And perhaps had more impact.
Yeah.
But once the Fringe went annual, the festival had to go annual. But it's still, you know, I think it'll be a splendid festival, and Fringe, and it's a marvellous time. Not that I'll see much of it because I'm so busy working.
That's right. Well, if we speak about Adelaide and the festival and the Fringe and a whole lot of things about the arts, it's the perfect place for a gentleman of your persuasion, because really, Adelaide's always punched above its weight, but in the arts area, Peter.
It has, I think, and it's, because it's a smaller city, it suits a festival. You know, festivals tend to get lost in bigger cities.
Yep.
I mean, you can go to Sydney when the Sydney Festival's on and not even realise that it's on. But in Adelaide, it's unmistakable. You know, everywhere you look, there it is. You know, Writers' Week is a marvellous part of the Adelaide Festival there in the Pioneer Women's Gardens behind Government House. It's magnificent. I was honoured to be part of it last year with my second book, and you interviewed me about that, In the Air of an Afternoon Almost Past. I seem to have these, everything's got a complicated title with me.
Wonderful book, actually.
Do you forget
book.
What you've written? Thank you. Do you forget what you've written, Greg T. Ross?
Yes, someone will say to me, I really like that piece on such and such. And to be honest with you, Peter, a lot of the time I have to go searching for it to find out where it was and what it was about.
I know.
Yeah, because
and someone said to me the other day, they reminded me of something that I'd written about Gallipoli. And I said, oh, yes, that was in the Sunday Mail, you know, years ago. And they said, no, it was on air. And then I had forgotten that I think about 2 years ago, my boss at the ABC commissioned these little pieces about Gallipoli, which I recorded and we broadcast. And they were broadcast nationally as little drop-ins.
Yeah.
And I thought, and I'd lost the copy that I'd written. And so I got the audio from the ABC and transcribed them. And I'm turning them into a little chapbook with other, because I'm fascinated by Gallipoli.
Yep.
And having visited it 18 times when I was living in Turkey. And so I thought, well, waste not, want not. So I'm trying to turn that into a little book. But and it might be of use to people who do, you know, are involved in dawn services all over the country or in commemoration. And I think I'll produce it and give it to the RSL to sell.
Oh, that might be an idea. That might be an idea, and we can cover that in the magazine too, Peter. Actually, talking about Gallipoli, and the veteran, you do so much. It's an amazing reflection on your character and spirit and energy. And I know that you're still very young, but you know, you do have a great energy.
Do I? I don't know. I mean, it's all done. It's all done with smoke and mirrors. You know, you can't. I don't know. Well, you just, you know, it's one foot in front of the other, and away you go. And see, work is more fun than fun, Greg T. Ross. You know, work is more fun than fun.
That's right. I can't think of retiring because. What would I do? I'm having fun with the magazine and the podcast, particularly when we interview people like yourself, Peter. And you've been... Could I just let listeners know that you're a stalwart on ABC Evenings for so how many years?
20 years.
20 years. And
but did you... sorry.
No, I was just going to say, Peter, that even after I moved back to Melbourne, I would listen to you on the ABC app because I needed some culture injection. And... I remember walking up the fish and chip shop one night and you're coming out loud and clear. I had the phone stuck in my pocket and people were wondering who the hell this guy was speaking on the through the phone. It was, of course, Peter Gurr's nightly program. We miss you.
Thank you. But some people are easier to interview than others. You know, I was reminded, Brenda Nile, who's a Melbourne writer, was sent by, remember Bob Santa Maria?
Who could forget Bob Santa Maria?
Well, he had that little show. It was a sort of, he paid for. He was Catholic Rite, wasn't he? He every Sunday morning on Channel 9, I think it was, up would pop Bob Santa Maria with his point of view.
Yes. And he had a very funny voice, a bit like Alan Jones, and he sort of spoke like that through his nose.
He reminds me
and
of George Brandis.
He railed against communism.
George Brandis's voice.
Yes, he looked like George Brandis.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Brenda, very long time ago in the 50s, Brenda Nile was sent by Bob Santa Maria to interview Archbishop Mannix. who was a bit of a hero of mine, and I think a wonderful Australian, because, of course, he led the opposition to conscription in the First World War, rightly so.
That's right.
We've only ever had conscription during the Vietnam War, and we must never have it again. Mm. You know, hundreds of thousands of Australians have volunteered freely to fight foreign wars. Why should we be induced to fight war? You know, it was a snub to all those volunteers. Anyway, Mannix opposed that. Wonderful. Anyway, he lived at, was it Rathine in Melbourne, which is the Pratt family house now at Toorak. And he was nearly 100. And she was sent to interview him, and he had an ancient housekeeper who was nearly as old as him. And she led him through this notoriously cold mansion, the Archbishop's Palace, where he was notorious for sitting in a Melbourne winter with a one-bar radiator. Tea was duly served. And she said to Archbishop Mannix, who was very severe and remote, she said, Your Grace, what do you care to recall your childhood in Ireland? And he looked at her, and 20 minutes later he said, no.
Oh, 20 minutes later. Oh, Peter.
And she thought, well, this is going well. This is going well. It's the all-time nightmare interview.
Yeah, well, we do both have history of interviewing many wonderful people. And, of course, interspersed with that is the people that you don't come across so well, I guess, Peter.
Yeah, well, you know, you get that. But then, and or even worse, when you switch the microphone off and then suddenly you get all the good stuff.
Yes, yes.
I remember interviewing Toni Lamond, who's now, should be in her 90s, the great star of Australian stage. Mm-hmm. And after the interview, walking her out, she suddenly, and she wouldn't mind me saying this because she has subsequently fessed up to this, but walking out, she said, you know, I had an affair with, I can't think of his, Johnny O'Keefe.
All right.
And I thought, wow, I wish you'd about that on air. But, you know, that was once the microphone had been switched off. That can be tricky.
Yeah, actually, that's very
when
true.
When you get the, all the goods.
That's very true. Actually, Peter, it reminds me of obviously a man that we knew of. I knew him, Tim Page, and I'll talk to you about Tim and Sean Flynn in a moment.
Yes.
But Tim and I were doing an interview at his place in northern New South Wales, and anyhow, the interview finished. We stayed up till about 2 a.m. So after the interview, he's telling me all these things. So what I actually called that was the best interview with him that never happened.
Exactly. He was amazing, wasn't he? I'm fascinated by Sean Flynn, and you've run stories thanks to Tim Page on him, because they were mates with Vietnam.
Yes, they're very, very, very close
mates.
Because
his body's never been Sean Flynn, the son of Errol Flynn, who was a press photographer who was one of many who were killed in Vietnam. I don't think his body's ever been located, has it?
No, it hasn't, Peter. And what Tim's focus was very strongly on finding the remains of his mate, Sean Flynn, and they found his camera, but they never found Sean because, of course, he'd been last seen with the Khmer Rouge with another journalist and was never seen again. They're on their motorbikes, intercepted by the Khmer Rouge. So it's pretty sure what happened to them. But Tim was, he was determined to find his mate's remains. But, of course, unfortunately, Tim died in 2022, and we'll never find out, I guess.
No, they were heroic, those press photographers, those war photographers, incredible. No, you brought him to us, and yes, Sean Flynn, well remembered. I once interviewed Rory Flynn, who was Errol Flynn's daughter, and she said that her father wanted to call his memoirs In Like Me. In Like Me by Errol Flynn. But his publisher wouldn't let it. He was a roaring boy. I've toured Hobart twice now. And there's a man who does tours of Hobart, and I've used him and visited all the houses Errol Flynn and his family lived in Hobart. They, strangely enough, lived in about six houses. They were forever on the move. Maybe they didn't pay their rent. And he's not remembered sufficiently enough in Hobart. There should be a statue to Errol Flynn in Hobart.
That's right. That's right. Of course, Sean tried acting too, but found his true love was war photography, war journalism, if you like, too. So, yeah. Well, we'll try and in honour of Tim and obviously his partner, Marianne. We will continue to try and bring this to light. I'm due to speak to Marianne soon, maybe tonight actually, and I'll mention your interest continues. See what we can do.
There's a group called Operation Aussies Home, which was run by a man called Jim Burke,
right,
who sadly is no longer. But they were the ones who found, with no help from the government, they found the remains of the last two Australians missing in action in Vietnam. The South Australian was... Oh, no, I see names. Anyway, the two of them. One was Robert Carver. I think he was a Queenslander. And the other one, sadly, I'm forgetting his name. But this was about, 10 years ago. Their bodies were finally found by Operation Aussies Home. Once they'd found the bodies, the Air Force moved in and repatriated them. But we're not as good as we should be. The Americans are much better at that. They leave no one, back. There's a whole unit in Hawaii that is just dedicated to finding the remains of American servicemen. But we're sloppy when it comes to that. Australians, military, sadly.
Yeah.
But Michael Herbert was the South Australian airman. Michael Herbert from South Australia and Robert Carver from Queensland were the last two missing in action.
Well done. Mm.
Yeah.
And so, Peter, you've been of great, held in high regard in South Australia by the veteran community for your work. And once again, we won't even call it work because, of course, it is a blessing to be able to do it. And I know that you enjoy it. The Dawn Service, you're doing that this year?
Well, I hope so. I, retired from the ABC and then they used me this year to do the Dawn Service,
right,
which I was honoured to do for the, that was my, 20th year doing it, yes. That's always a great honour to do that. And I think, and you would agree, Greg T. Ross, that as Australians we should be judged on our attitudes to veterans. Mm-hmm. Because after all, they have sacrificed, and in many ways, in many cases, in 101,000 cases, paid the ultimate sacrifice for us. So it's our duty to honour them and to help them. Plus, the Vietnam veterans especially, I've never known better people than Vietnam veterans, more forgiving or more compassionate people than the Vietnam veterans, considering what they went through. And we owe them an special debt of honour because of the way we treated them after the war. And we made that huge mistake as a nation and we blamed the soldiers for the war, which, of course, we must never do again. And that was a very expensive lesson that they had to carry.
Yeah, well articulated, Peter. And yes, totally agree. You speak of forgiveness, and I guess it's coincidental, I don't know, but the Vietnamese people themselves are so forgiving.
They are, aren't they? And I mean, I went to Vietnam with a party of diggers, some of whom go there all the time, and they support an orphanage in Vung Tau, which is dealing with the descendants of those affected by the appalling chemical warfare of Agent Orange and napalm, because it's generational. And this is an orphanage for kids of the most, or people of the most shocking disabilities and deformities. And these are working men, retired now, and they put everything they've got into this orphanage. So some of them return all the time, and some of the diggers I went with had never been back. And it was extraordinary to be to be with them. One of them, Roger Cook, was an engineer who'd laid roads in the in Vung Tau province, and he was, you know, overwhelmed to see those roads still there in 50 years later and still being used by the vigorous modern Vietnamese. He did, on his return, out that the biggest shareholder in the road company for which he was working was Lady Bird Johnson, the then wife of President Lyndon Baines Johnson. There, does it? Nothing changed. People make money out of wars, don't they? A lot of money out of a lot of wars. And he was, you know, look at the, you know, we had that, all that scandal with, you know, the American corporations in the Iraq and Afghanistan war. And he was an example of that, that, you know, the road building company was an American concern. Not military, but private.
That's incredible. So thank you so much, Peter Gerz, art raconteur, art director, producer, critic, former ABC announcer. There's not much that you haven't done in the world of arts. Greatly respected in the veteran community, and fingers crossed that you'll be hosting the Dawn Service again this year, as you've done for the last 20 years. Peter Gerz, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you in the Last Post Radio Show.
Thank you, Ross, and viva the Last Post.
You're listening to Greg T. Ross and the Last Post Radio Show.